I'm going to be talking about pheromone-based disruption of citrus leaf miner. As a quick background, the citrus leaf miner is an important introduced pest to Florida. It came in 1993, and now it's highly widespread. And the pest status, just to let you know why it's important while we're working on this, the larval mining does affect leaf growth and shoot growth, and this can impact growth of particularly young trees. But perhaps the more important reason why the citrus leaf miner is an important pest is its association with bacterial citrus canker, which is a very important disease in Florida citrus. And while this is not a true vector of the disease, it predisposes the citrus, because the larval feeding basically opens wounds that the bacteria can then infect, causing large sources of inoculum. So without the benefit of this wounding, the bacteria can only enter through the stomata. So this is it's highly important because of that. I'm new to Florida, and I'm learning that the prolonged and rain that takes place often results in a lot of flushing, so chemical sprays are ineffective to a large degree, because there's always new flush and there's always new food. The leaf miner pheromone was reported on recently by two groups, and it's unfortunately a pretty complex blend. There are three aldehydes, but the two-component blend of the trine and diene alone will result in the full behavioral repertoire, and this has been confirmed in Florida. So this blend of the trine and diene are the sort of the behaviorally active pheromone in the U.S. And the reason I say the U.S. is because there appears to be a host race in Japan that uses the diene alone. So the objectives I'll be talking about today were to evaluate the potential of using mating disruption as a new control tactic for this important pest. But coming from Jim Miller's lab, I'm very interested in the mechanisms underlying mating disruption. So the studies I'll be telling you about were sort of designed to gain some type of an understanding of mechanisms. And particularly, we wanted to test the predictions outlined by these two recently published Miller et al. Papers that Jim mentioned. By developing these moth catch versus dispenser density profiles, which we believe can help us gain insights on whether competitive attraction or false plume following is the operative mechanism versus non-competitive mechanisms such as habituation or camouflage. And then we wanted to also gain some behavioral data to substantiate this. So just our methods in brief. It's really simple. This is just initial proof of concept work. Our release devices are just the simple rubber septa. We load them differently for whether there are mating disruption dispensers versus our monitoring lures. We hang these dispensers about mid-canopy in 4 meter tall trees. We found that that's where these guys hang out mostly. And our trials are conducted in small plots, 30 tree. They're big trees, so it turns out to be about 0.14 hectares. It's replicated 5 times. And as is typical of mating disruption trials, we're evaluating efficacy with monitoring traps that are serving as female proxies. I typically like to use virgin females in these cases, but if you've never seen a citrus leaf miner, they're so small that became impossible. So we've got two of these female proxies per plot, and we're also, of course, from the practical aspect, looking at flush infestation on a weekly basis by looking at 20 shoots from 20 trees per plot. And here are the dispenser densities that we evaluated to develop these profiles, and they range from the control 0 per tree to 1 every 5th tree, 1 per tree, 5 per tree, and you can see what that extrapolation would be on a per hectare basis. And what I'd like to draw your attention to is we're working at what I would consider at least remarkably low amounts of pheromone per area of crop. Our highest AI is only 1.4 grams, and this is about 160 times less pheromone than is typical for disruption of other pests, such as tortricids, where you're typically using about 100 or 200 grams per hectare, or 100 to 200 to get effective disruption. So just to start with some of the data, these are the means for the entire season, and we deployed those dispensers twice, once at the beginning of the season in April and then once mid-season in June. I redeployed because I got the hint that perhaps efficacy was waning, and maybe I jumped the gun on this. But so if we look in this upper panel, this is the mean number of males per trap over season long, and we're getting what I would consider robust disruption, 98% disruption of male orientation to traps. And it our despite the small plot size, our flusher infestation was low, which would bode well for using this on a larger scale. As we know, mating disruption works more robustly in a large plot setting. So this is likely due to immigration of females that had very large buffers, and they're highly infested. So the disruption is robust. And just to give you an illustration, you know, this is the typical catch of males per week in the untreated control. You're literally catching thousands of moths. So we're up against really incredibly high population densities. So now let's move a little bit to those mathematical predictions that Jim alluded to that he and colleagues developed at Michigan State. And we developed some profiles and mathematical equations that we feel fit the predictions of competitive attraction. And I'm not going to go into this great detail, but these are theoretical data. And in competitive attraction, if you plot catch, which is males per trap, per area of crop per night, per hectare, against dispenser density per hectare, under competitive attraction, we see this steep initial decline in catches with increasing dispenser density and asymptotic approach. Then we can transform these data to two companion profiles. One is one over catch versus dispenser density. This has been coined the Miller-Goop plot. And the second one is catch over dispensers per hectare times catch. And it gives you this nice linear plot with a negative slope. So these are the predictions of competitive attraction. And non-competitive attraction does not share this series of characteristics. For non-competitive attraction, in this untransformed plot, we do not see that steep initial drop in catches. For the Miller-Goop plot, you get this concave shape. It's nonlinear. And this one might be the most diagnostic, is this catch versus dispenser's density times catch. It gives you this characteristic recurved shape. And we believe that non-competitive attraction here operates by subtraction. So those are the theoretical data. Let's see what we actually got with the citrus leaf miner. I think that's a remarkable fit to the predictions of non-competitive attraction. These are the actual data we found. If you look at the untransformed plot, we don't get that initial steep drop. You get this nonlinear plot with a concave shape, and you get the characteristic recurve shape. Now, some may argue that a lot of this depends on this final point, but I think if you look at the profiles as a whole, again, we go back to the theoretical data and what we got with citrus leaf miner, I think it's a really good fit. So now, let's look at the behavior of the moths in the field. The profile analyses would suggest non-competitive attraction. So a prediction of this would be if something like habituation or desensitization is mediating, or a combination of both, disruption in this case, you'd predict that you shouldn't be able to observe these moths, these male moths, approaching dispensers in the treated plots. So we've done a series of behavioral observations at night with night vision goggles when these guys occur. And over 13 nights of two-hour observations and plots treated with all these dispenser densities, we're not able, we've never observed a single male. Here's Wendy Meyer doing her best to see them. But yet if we go to an untreated plot, we can readily observe these males approaching the dispensers. So we're simply not seeing them under mating disruption. Another thing you might ask, well, perhaps those dispensers that we were using as the mating disruption treatment were releasing pheromone above some behaviorally active threshold where males were simply breaking off and plume following and that's why we didn't observe them. Well, we also tested that hypothesis by carrying out a rather long trapping study where we compared the mean number of males caught with the monitoring lure, the disruption dispenser, versus a blank trap. And although we caught fewer males with these higher loading disruption dispensers, we're still able to catch them. So I would say that the bottom line conclusion here is that these dispensers do attract males in a non-treated plot. However, we're not able to see them under mating disruption. So again, I would say that this is further corroborating evidence that disruption in this case is acting by a non-competitive mechanism such as camouflage or desensitization. So to make some conclusions, we can get robust disruption, in my opinion, of this moth season-long with what I consider a remarkably low amount of pheromone per hectare. Flush infestation was reduced even in the small plots. This bodes well for using this technology on a larger scale. The transformation profiles of moth catch versus dispenser density were consistent with non-competitive attraction, and this is sort of a rare case because in the cases where we did do these transformations for other species, we found that the preponderance of cases supported competitive attraction. So this is actually one of the rarer cases. And I contend that the biological data, both the behavioral observations and trapping, are also consistent with the theoretical predictions. Again, this bodes well for control of the species since it occurs at such high population densities. We're lucky that something like non-competitive attraction is operating because it renders the disruption largely density independent, which is sort of the Achilles heel of disruption by competitive attraction. Thanks. Yes, Tom.
One of the other Achilles heels for using aldehydes is that they seem to dimerize and polymerize. And you mentioned that you redeploy them. Do you think there's a issue there that needs to be addressed as far as the longevity of the aldehydes?
Very much so. We were quite excited with how well it was protected and active in this case. I think the non-competitive attraction mechanism, and perhaps it's something like sensory imbalance here, is working in our favor because we might not need that perfectly attractive blend if attraction to the dispenser isn't the operative mechanism. But you bring up the Achilles heel of my problem in trying to approach industry and say, hey, I got this aldehyde, I want you to formulate it for me. So yeah, that's going to be a problem.
That was tackled. People tried to tackle that, but maybe the form is, maybe an analog.
Yeah. Thanks.
Thank you. We're going to move on to the next presentation.